two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Happy 2024! New year, new you, right? Let me guess. You're thinking about joining a new gym, starting a fad diet, buying that Theragun everyone's always yammering on about. I've got a better idea. Listen to my podcast. I'm Samantha Bee, writer, comedian, and host of Choice Words from Lemonada Media. This whole month of January, we're going to help you make better choices in 2024. We'll go beyond superficial hacks and get at the truth of how to lead a more meaningful life. Just search for Choice Words on your podcast player of choice and hit follow so you don't miss an episode. Now that is a good choice.
Lemonada.
In just a few minutes, Jill and I, Kamala and Doug, we'll hold a moment of silence here in the White House, the people's house, your house. We ask you to join us, to remember so we can heal, to find purpose in the work ahead, to show that there is light in the darkness. This nation will smile again. This nation will know sunny days again. This nation will know joy again. And as we do, we'll remember each person we've lost, the lives they lived, the loved ones they left behind. We will get through this, I promise you. But my heart aches for you, those of you who are going through it right now. May God bless you all, particularly those who've lost someone. God bless you.
Welcome to In the Bubble. I'm Dr. Bob Wachter. Of course, that was President Joe Biden on Monday night, marking the incalculable loss of 500,000 Americans. Just let that sink in for a minute. 500,000 Americans, tragic at every level, including the fact that our response was such that some of that did not have to happen. But it's really wonderful having an administration marked by empathy that takes the time to talk about the lives of the people that we've lost and the lives of the people they left behind, and doing in ways that focuses on truth, on common sense, and on healing. And healing starts with remembering what we've lost and these individual lives and all the people that love them. It's a really interesting moment in a way, because as tragic as it is, it also is a time of some optimism. And the president hinted at that when he talked about light in the darkness and that we will come through this. And we will, and most of the signs are pretty positive at this point. And one of the most positive signs is that we now have an exceptional team that the president has put together that is in charge of making it so. And they are sweating the details. They are telling us the truth. They are telling us what they know and what they don't know. They are not giving us happy talk. But they are pushing the system to move faster and faster with an eye not on the politics, but an eye on making sure that no one dies unnecessarily, that every life is important and every life that can be saved is saved. And the person who is really quarterbacking that team, and in many ways has become the most public face of that team, is someone you may know from this podcast, a guy named Andy Slavitt, who has taken a leave from the podcast to do just that. And of course, we're grateful that he's doing that. Andy, of course, is now the White House senior advisor for the COVID response. Under the Obama administration, he led Medicare and Medicaid. And over the last several years, he's done a whole lot of things that have been important, probably the most important of which was launching this podcast, for which I know we're all grateful. My interview with Andy covers a lot of issues. You'll hear that the first probably two thirds is a lot of the issues of the day. We talk a lot about vaccines. We talk about the schools. We talk about getting back to normal and what that looks like and when that might happen. And then toward the end, we get into more personal stuff. We talk about Andy's experience in the White House, what it's like bumping into Kamala on the lawn, what it's like being called into the Oval for a meeting, what dealing with President Biden is like, and some of the contrast between his style and that of Barack Obama. It's really, really interesting stuff. And Andy helps us see what's going on behind the curtain. And through it all, you'll hear something that won't surprise you, which is Andy's extraordinary passion for the issues and the fact that he understands that what they're doing is unbelievably important and ultimately will determine how fast we get through this thing and how many people live or die. So the stakes couldn't be higher. I'm thrilled that Andy is in the hot seat doing the hard work, and it's really a wonderful chance to get to catch up with him. So with that, let us ring up Andy Slavitt.
So I've got to do a press briefing at the top of the hour, whatever time it is.
Let's do it.
Okie dokie.
The interviews have gotten a lot tougher since things have changed here. Are you ready for it?
Yeah, let's go. Give it to me straight.
Andy, thanks for coming on. We're taping this on the day that we've reached 500,000 deaths. So why don't we start? Just tell us what that number means to you.
You know, it's easy to think about that number. It's harder to feel that number, I'm finding. Feeling, you know, people's family members and their hopes and their dreams and the missed years and the sadness of the people who are missing them is really hard to do. I guess from my perspective, there's a message which says, work harder, Slavitt. Don't let this kind of commemoration continue indefinitely. Let the public rest and get back to the other worries and joys in their life. You know, the president is going to be making some remarks tonight with the vice president and with their spouses. And, you know, it's kind of a chilling day. I'm sure it is for you too, Bob.
Sure. That's, yeah, you're right. I mean, you try to get your arms around the number and, you know, the size of the city of Atlanta or five University of Michigan football stadiums. It's, you can kind of get a sense, but trying to put yourself in the place of each person, each family, it's almost incomprehensible. I think our brains do something to protect us from that, and you have to kind of fight that so you truly understand the enormity of what's going on. Is your feeling kind of mirrored by the folks you're working with? Are people sort of taking stock of the moment and pushing themselves to work even harder based on this milestone?
Yeah, I mean, I will say something about the team here. I mean, this is a team of people probably in the White House and, well, there's two teams, right? People team in the White House who have come in who are incredibly prepared and have been through things like this before and have a lot of energy for this and are probably some, you know, by my joke, some of the best people in the world at doing this. And then the people in the agencies, the people who you know and know of in the CDC and the FDA and NIH, they've always been some of the best people in the world at doing this. They haven't been always recognized as the people that can do this job. And so the easiest part of this job is coming in and telling these folks, we trust you. You know the answers. You are unleashed. Go tell it like it is, and we will wrap a strategy around you. Tell us what you need to get done. And so I think there's a lot, I would report that there's a lot of energy among people who feel like they can finally do their jobs.
That's great to hear. So we'll start with some questions about kind of what's going on in Washington. And we had some listener questions too, and a lot of interesting questions from listeners. One was from Mimi Siegel, who said, where do you think you've made the biggest progress? What's been harder than you thought? What's been easier than you thought?
I feel like there is zero declaration of victory or success yet in any way. So I want to avoid that refrain. I'd rather look back and say, boy, look at the things we did well and look at things we could have done better. But we're in the middle of it now. And I don't want anybody in this country to have a sense that we're done. As we know, and as I think I've heard you say on this podcast, the pandemic has had nothing but surprises for us along the way. And so we need to continue to anticipate bad surprises.
Yeah.
You know, I think we lived for a long time with an administration that, I'll put it this way, really wanted it to be over and wanted to keep promising it to be over. And I think that was fatiguing for people to feel like no one's preparing for a marathon. So look, I'd rather, if we prepare people for a marathon and it only ends up being a 10-mile run, a 10K or whatever, what a great analogy I've used. See, I've still got game, Bob.
That's unbelievable. Yeah, you haven't lost it.
Pull those things out.
I worried with shaving and, you know, the haircut and all that, that you might have lost your superpowers, but it's still there.
The tie chokes off blood supply.
The tie is a problem. Yeah, it does.
So I think we're being very cautious from a communication standpoint in not to overpromise, not to declare victory, to be very blunt about the challenges and to encourage others to be blunt about the challenges. And then people will feel progress. They won't hear about progress. They're going to feel progress when it feels right to them. And then leave it to you and others and other commentators to tell people what some of this stuff means and avoid interpreting and overselling the results. That's sort of the ethic I've tried to bring in. It's consistent with the president's ethic, so it makes it easy. It's consistent with Ron Klain's ethic, Jeff Zients' ethic, Rochelle Walensky, Tony Fauci. And so it feels like the cultural focus on do stuff, don't talk about stuff, but be very transparent along the way is what we're trying to hit.
How do you get the balance right between that and some people are talking about not being optimistic enough, sort of too much of a bummer, a million doses a day? Well, we should be aiming for 2 or 3 million. We'll have enough vaccines for everybody in July. Well, actually, the month might be May.
Yeah.
You know, it's a tricky balance to get right. How do you think about that?
I'm not sure we do get it right, but I think we have an approach, which is if we say July and it's May, when it comes to May, people will forgive us. Between now and whenever it is, May, June, July, August, September, people are going to be uncomfortable and uneasy. So there's nothing to do to change that. There's no words to change that. I mean, I do think like people are eager for us to say, answer some questions like, okay, well, once I have my vaccine, to your episode, unsafe or unsafe, what is it safe to do? And we've asked the scientific team here to advise on that and think about that and go to work on that. And I'm okay if we're a little later than you and Farzad and others at doing that, because I'd rather be stepwise and not have to walk anything back. But when people ask me, what can I do now that I couldn't do before I got vaccinated? My answer is pretty simple. Live. You can live. You don't have to worry about dying. And let's build from that.
Yeah. Let's talk about the vaccine rollout. When you came in, it was a mess. The numbers were a mess. We didn't know how many doses were out there. The distribution was a mess. Sort of what did you, on day one, what did you discover and how did you set to cleaning it up? And how do you think you've done?
So a couple of things. First of all, there's no upside in kind of having an administration that spends a lot of time blaming the last administration. I don't think the public wants that, number one. Number two, you know, we've got to get out of the trap where Democrats feel one way about a vaccine or a mask and Republicans feel another way. So I think it's potentially isolating to people who don't identify with the current administration to kind of continually cast blame. At the same time, in order to be clear with the public and say, look, here's the facts, here's what they are, we've had to do some of that. So we've had to say, look, we didn't inherit a stockpile of vaccines sitting there ready to go. We didn't inherit the amount of manufacturing that had been implied. We were told there'd be 40 million doses done by December, 100 million by January. Those were very far off. So we had to level set. And in level setting, we probably looked a little bit critical of the past administration. And the truth is, I think we are doing things differently. For one, which is working for a different president, a president who is into the details, cares deeply, wants the plain truth spoken, doesn't really care as much how it reflects on him as he does that we get the job done. That's a different kind of president to work for. And so there were very good people in the last administration, I know, but they were working for a president with different expectations and different kind of communication priorities. Second thing is, I think I'd simplify it to say that the prior administration was focused on vaccines and we're focused on vaccinations. So producing vaccines is one thing. Getting them in people's arms, that last mile, as it were, and the whole communication process around should I trust the vaccine, should I not, and all of the places and locations, having enough vaccinators, having enough vaccine sites, being located in the right communities, that has equal effort for us because otherwise you're just producing vaccines. So when we got here, 46% of vaccines that had been delivered had been administered, 46%. Today, that number bounces around, but it's in the 80s. We've done a few things. We've increased the number of vaccines going out the door by 60-some percent, and a much higher percentage of them are actually getting into people's arms. And we've purchased all the vaccines needed to take care of the public, not even counting Johnson & Johnson, because we are not going to take into account facts that are not yet in evidence, even though we're hopeful, of course, of Johnson & Johnson, which is a very, very good vaccine. And we have created more vaccinators, more community health sites. We're standing up large FEMA sites. In short, I think we're treating this like an emergency, and we can't make vaccines come off the line any faster than they physically can, and then they physically can safely. And that is a large part of the process. So we're not going to do that, but we are going to do is every single thing else. And, you know, again, in terms of how are we doing at it, I want to reserve that judgment for when this thing is all done. And I will guarantee you, we will have made mistakes. I will guarantee you, we will have done some things well, but every step along the way, we are trying to evaluate what lessons we're learning and try to improve and working really, really hard, because I feel like there's no way to work hard enough given what the public is going through. There's no way that the public expects us to sleep well at night if they can't sleep well at night. That's just my attitude.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
I know that equity has been central to your thinking about this issue from the start. How have you been handling the issue of equity when it comes to vaccinations? What did you think the fundamental challenges were, and how are you and the team addressing them?
Yeah, that's such a great point. I mean, I've come to believe through all my years in healthcare that if you do nothing, if you just ignore the issue, structural disadvantages will reign significantly. Because for some people, it's just easier to get on computers. It's easier to get places. It's easier to take time off work. It's easier to have, you know, people drive you to places. It's easier to get childcare. Just all of those things add up to a tremendous disadvantage. Unfortunately, though, this is both an occupational disease based on what job you're in. You're more exposed. It's also a where you live disease. It's a color of your skin disease. It's all of those things. And yet the people that at the outset are clamoring for the vaccine are able to easily clamor over other people. Not their intent. They're not bad people. It's understandable. And it's what happens in a shortage. Mm-hmm. Point is, you have to do very specific, explicit things or you won't fix it. So having a certain portion of appointments reserved for people in the community, in your zip code, having morning appointments reserved for people in these locations, having mobile clinics, using community health centers, using mobile vans into clinics. That's a large part of the challenge. The other part of the challenge is not just the access, but it's also the conversation, what people call vaccine hesitancy or people call vaccine confidence, which is really not about, you know, a message. It's about allowing someone to have a conversation about their reasonable questions. Because I don't look at everybody who's a fence sitter and say, well, they're anti-vaccine or they're ignorant. Far from it. Everybody's got a question. It's got a legitimate question because it's their question. And if they can get an answer on the internet that misleads them or is not based on fact, that's a problem. That's a loss. But if you can get them to a reliable, trusted source, whether it's their local doctor, church leader, pharmacist, to the CDC, then you can say, yes, your question's legitimate. And here's what we know. And here's what we don't know. And so, you know, you may know that we do these Monday, Wednesday, Friday briefings that I initiated when I got here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have Rochelle Walensky from CDC, Tony Fauci from NIAID, who basically speak it completely unscripted, i.e. the White House doesn't look at what they have to say. They just say it like it is. Reporters come in and ask questions. They give straight answers. They say what they know. They say what they don't know. We talk about adverse events. And thankfully, the facts are easy because this is an incredibly effective and incredibly safe set of vaccines that have been approved. So we're fortunate that it's easy to, if you can get the facts out.
Is there a broad communication strategy rolling out or being developed that says there are some people for whom Fauci and you and others are not the answer? It is the church leader. It is the sports star. It is the TikTok star. I mean, it's the people that they trust from other parts of their life. And kind of what does that look like?
Yes, it's 100% TikTok. No, I'm kidding.
100%. I don't even know what TikTok is.
We're putting on our marbles and a kid on a skateboard. He's going to really carry the message for us.
That's probably right.
No, I think it's a great question. So yes, there's three stages to this process, and we've just finished the first stage and are entering the second stage. The first stage has been getting smart, listening to people, testing messages, understanding what the data say, understanding who wants vaccines and what's getting in their way. And there's a series of both universal lessons and lessons specific to different communities. And we've just finished that stage and we've learned a ton and it's been very helpful. And a lot of it is behavioral economists talking about how to break down barriers. And some of it is what people in communities are saying and so forth. The second stage, which as I said, begins today, Monday. When is the show airing?
Wednesday.
Well, we will have begun when the show airs. Is a huge stakeholder engagement effort. So we are meeting with leaders in the African-American community, practitioners from around the country, people in all different communities, and we are gathering their input and talking to them about what we've learned and understanding what they've learned. Then the third stage is going to be the much more public kind of communication conversation stage, which is going to be timed to be most effective, i.e. when there is enough vaccine for people to get those messages. And I think we're going to spend a lot of money, but it's not about a message. It's about a conversation. It's about listening to people. And it's about, as you say, local people who people trust and have it extensible so that, you know, it can be localized. That's the idea. And it's really important because sure as today we've got people chasing vaccines, at some amount of time, we're going to have vaccines chasing people. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, we need to be ready to go.
Everybody wants to know that date. You've already said you want to sort of not overpromise. And the president said July was that date that vaccines would be available to everybody. Is that the date that you think is the right date, or you think that's on the conservative side?
So I think what he said was we will have purchased and produced enough vaccines for every American by the end of July. And that only accounts for Moderna and Pfizer. And so, you know, we will continue to update as we learn more. But I think it's important. I mean, look, I don't think there's anything wrong with people preparing to say, look, I'm probably going to get my vaccine some point this spring. And some of the answer to this, Bob, depends on the previous conversation we just had, which is how many people want the vaccine? Because if that number is lower, then more people will get it, will be able to get it who want it, we'll get it more quickly. If that number is higher, which we hope it is, it might take a little bit longer. So, you know, I don't think that it does anybody any good to have any create any false precision. I'd rather not have a sense of false precision. And if people want to have a date in their mind, I'd rather have them have a date that feels a little bit like an outside date, but knows that we're working hard to pull that date in. In fact, when the president said July 31st, it was only 2 weeks before that I had said it was September 30th. And it was. But we took a series of actions, including the Defense Production Act, including contract work, including scaling up some things that gave us confidence to move that September date to the July date. And we'll leave it at that July date unless and until something changes.
Stay on vaccines for a couple more minutes, then pivot to a few other things. Carrie Tanney asked a really good question. This is a toughie. The CDC says that people who've been in close contact with someone who has COVID are not required to quarantine if they've been fully vaccinated. However, the CDC also says after exposure, people can be infected or carry the virus. So this sort of question that we're not 100% sure that you're incapable of carrying it and spreading it. And she asks, how can both of these above statements be true? Tricky issue, you know, this issue where we're telling people that we don't know for sure you can't catch it and spread it. And then the CDC came out and said you don't need to quarantine. So I assume the scientists are grappling with that. But how are you thinking about that one?
Yeah, I think it's all about relative risk reduction. And that, you know, because there is some chance that people can have some amount of viral load and can be infectious, that they should be wearing masks whenever they're in public. And that may be like, could turn out that that was an extra layer of protection, but a pretty low cost kind of public health protection, right? Wearing a mask. So I think that's why that's being encouraged. Whereas saying, hey, you know, you've had two vaccinations, you've got a very low chance of getting COVID, and we're still asking you to miss work and stay home for a week. From a relative risk standpoint, that feels like no, you know? And so the CDC, I mean, I'm trying to explain CDC decision-making, and that's certainly their role, not mine. But when they come to these conclusions based upon a lot of work, argument, discussion, analysis, with particularly with outside folks, and they know every time they make a decision, it's subject to questioning and criticism, as in, are you going too fast? Are you going too slow? How does that work? What about the 0.1% of people to whom that won't work for? They can't make decisions and parse them that thinly. They've got to make basically sensible decisions and hopefully explain them well. And it's a very fair question, but that's how I interpret the answer.
Are you, I know one of your worries was that vaccines would get politicized the way masks were. Do you feel like that is not happening, that that part is going pretty well?
Well, so start with this. I think the data say that conservatives have a disproportionately lower acceptance of vaccines. But I don't know that that's necessarily a political thing. It might be, I mean, it may be political in that one of the reasons that people don't say that they don't like vaccines is they don't like the government telling them what to do. And if this feels heavy-handed from government, so they're more reluctant or more skeptical, that's not necessarily political. Mm-hmm. It may be cultural. It may be other things. You know, I was on Hugh Hewitt's show last week, and I've been talking to a lot of conservative evangelical leaders and people who are all very pro-vaccine, as pro-vaccine as you are, and are thrilled that I want to talk to them and that I want to talk to them publicly and speak about messaging. And so it's funny, when I was talking to Hugh, who is obviously a big conservative commentator, very well known, he said, we conservatives believe in science. We conservatives think vaccination is hugely important. And we think that we can move the needle on this. And so then I said, okay, let me try to go the next yard and ask you the question, what about masks? And he said, you know what? I wear a mask. I believe in masks. I haven't changed one mind about masks, and I don't think you will either. Hmm. So, you know, and at least in his telling, that is more baked. I'm not quite as pessimistic, although I would say, you know, a lot of water has gone under the bridge on masks that hasn't on vaccines. And so I think there's more opportunity to keep vaccinations from being politicized. That's an important part of our job.
Israel just enacted what seems like a national program of vaccine or immunity passports and having people show evidence of vaccination when they get into certain places. Do you think that's in the cards, whether that's proclaimed by you and the government or just de facto what businesses and airlines and other places do? And if that does begin to happen, what do you think that does to the public debate?
Unlikely that the government's going to have a real active role in that, and unlikely that the government should have an active role in that. I think it sort of encroaches on where people's concerns about taking vaccines are to some degree, to see that as a government thing. But as it has with the flu, people want to be safe. And whether it's a school or a business or an event, you know, they may in fact, and I want to stop short of this sounding like a U.S. government endorsement. Part of the problem I have, Bob, nowadays is I can't speak for me any longer. I can't say Andy's opinion is X, because it will be reported as White House advisors as X.
Sure.
So I'm going to tell you that White House has no position on this, that I know a lot of external folks are studying it, and that those things will evolve. And that's about as much of a cop-out as I can provide you.
That's pretty good. Yeah. You've learned the lingo in a few short weeks.
Yeah.
I'll throw another hot potato at you. So how do you think you guys are doing on the schools, and both in messaging and in reality in terms of the pronouncements that you've made so far?
Schools are not, it's not an easy issue, because if all schools could be open, they'd be open. And I do think what the CDC did is incredibly useful. They came out and said, look, every school can open safely if they do the right things, even if they're in a red zone, i.e. with high case count, even if they're in a low zone. And it's a matter of how, not if. But the how is really important. Can you de-densify, i.e. the number of students in the class? Can you require all the kids to wear masks, and will they? And they've, you know, really pretty good data, which says that if you do those things, you can open schools. And if you don't do those things, it's not as safe to do that. And so it's a line in the sand. But even with that, understand that people have very, very strong feelings on this topic. I mean, if you're a teacher and you hear that and you say, hey, I don't know if I feel safe, that's a very reasonable feeling. Likewise, if you're a grocery clerk and you have people coming into your store every day that are unvaccinated, you don't feel that safe. So this is a real, real issue. Mm-hmm. And then if you're a parent, or if you're an educator and you see the gap growing because kids aren't back in school, it's an issue that frustrates you. And, you know, I think to some degree, people want to decide that, is there an enemy in this equation? Should this be cast as parents against teachers and all that? I think that's really unhelpful and unhealthy and unfortunate. And I understand why it happens. But, you know, I think to some extent, everyone's trying to figure out this puzzle. So the CDC, for the first time, did something other than like what they did last year, which is just say open schools. They basically said, here's how. Those are still local decisions. So the administration can't go to the schools and do that. The other thing I have to say, though, is a school, very reasonable response from schools is, hey, fine, but we need resources to do that. And that's where the American Rescue Plan, which I probably should say about 20 more times on this show, American Rescue Plan, American Rescue Plan, American Rescue Plan, has to be passed by the Congress. I mean, this cannot be treated like anything other than a full orchestra to solve this. I mean, everybody, Americans, business leaders, clinicians, federal government, state governments, Congress, everybody has to do their part, and it becomes so much easier. And everything that's in the American Rescue Plan, the resources to do vaccinations, the resources for schools, the support for small businesses, the support for people on unemployment, all of those things have to be done, and they have to be done quickly. So we won't get all the way there without the help from Congress.
The next couple of months, we're talked a lot about vaccines and the rollout and all of that. There's also issues around the variants and how worried are you about them. So the public health behaviors and testing, there's a whole lot of, you know, are people going to let their guard down now that they see the case curves plummeting and the test positivity rate plummeting? There's another kind of messaging that's going to be very important to be sure that people don't completely let their guard down. How are you approaching that?
You just asked me like 7 questions at once.
One question at a time? Is that actually the rule? I had forgotten that.
Let's parse the questions out.
Good idea.
So you got a question of, you know, what people behavior, and are they too, am I concerned that they're going to let their guard down early? You got a question about variants.
Yeah.
Well, look, so to start with the variants. Yes, it's worrying. But I think it's more worrying short-term than long-term right now for me. I mean, I'm worried about another wave. I'm worried about people letting their guard down. You're exactly right. It's a real issue. And as the numbers drop and people start to feel like they're let their breath out, and it's great news that the numbers are dropping in cases, but it's not. The signs are always right around the corner with this pandemic, and as you've pointed out countless times. But long-term, though, I think getting a strategy and feeling like we can beat these variants, I feel better and better about, both because I think the vaccines are standing up well to the UK variant and reasonably well to the other ones, and because as of Monday, i.e. the day we're recording this, the FDA just released the guidance for the monoclonal antibodies, the vaccines, and the diagnostics that will allow all of science to keep up and ideally keep ahead on a more rapid basis with the development of these variants. I have had an opportunity to talk to the CEOs of all of the monoclonal antibody companies, all of the pharmaceutical companies. And while I wouldn't necessarily take everything they say to the bank, I hear a level of confidence in the early data that they're seeing that they feel pretty good. Science can beat this, but science with people's help can beat it a lot faster and a lot better than science and people letting their guard down. So you're exactly right. And come to think of it, I completely get why you combine those two questions.
It was a very good question, I think.
Yeah.
Welcome to The Dough, where cash is queen and we hardly know her, but we're still here figuring her out together because, y'all, season two is here. Hosted every week by me, X Maya. Remember me? I'm going to be talking to all types of people about their relationship to money. I'm talking to reality stars, entrepreneurs, financial experts, and even some of my own friends. Basically, anyone who will get real with me about their dollars, how they make money, how they spend it, and how they save it, because I'm trying to retire early, people. Season two of The Dough is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Can't get enough of your favorite Lemonada Media podcasts? By subscribing to Lemonada Premium today, you'll gain access to fun and inspiring bonus content from all of our podcasts across the Lemonada Media Network. As a subscriber, you can listen to never-before-heard interview excerpts, behind-the-scenes segments, and continue to uncover new ways to make life suck less through all of our exclusive subscriber audio. Check out a free trial of Lemonada Premium today in the Apple Podcast app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button.
Andy, tell us a little bit about how your life has been for the past month.
You're surprisingly busy. I bet you're surprised to hear that.
Yeah, I can't. I'm shocked. What have you been doing?
I think in a word, trying to think about the next life that we don't have to lose and how to make sure that we lose as few people as possible. That's what's taped to my desk in my office. And it's a pretty grounding principle on how to make decisions, whether it means that that's how we inform the public more honestly, or whether that is how aggressively we have to upset the apple cart if we want to buy more vaccines. You know, nothing else matters as much. And so, you know, it does range at a practical day-to-day level from making sure we procure enough vaccines, making sure those vaccines get efficiently and effectively out to the system, something you and I have talked about, Bob, making sure that when they're distributed, they get to the communities that need them the most, that have suffered the most, and that often get left behind. You know, there's a fair amount of, you know, trying to do 20 or 30 things to coordinating across the government and make sure you're doing them well. So every day has got really pretty filled.
How do you filter all the noise? Everybody's got an opinion about this. There's no issue more important than the world. You're hearing from the press. You're hearing from the political world. You're hearing from every armchair epidemiologist in the universe, including me. How do you filter that to make sure you're making the right call and not getting distracted?
It's a really great question, because the easy thing to do would say, filter out the noise, just do your job, focus on that mantra of saving people's lives. But that's not really truthfully the entire answer, because that would imply that you think you're doing everything right and you've got nothing to learn. And you can get too locked in to your point of view. So, you know, you and I have talked and you've challenged me on a couple of things. And I give you my reflexive answer, how I've thought about it. But I also then have to deeply consider your point of view, because particularly if you're someone credible as you are, or at least so I believe, that people... You just can't get locked in. So if you're telling me something, or I'm hearing something, or we're getting some criticism, the easiest thing to do is to reflect and defend yourself against criticism. The more challenging and appropriate thing to do is to say, where's the grain of truth in what people are experiencing? And how can we resolve that? And so, in some cases, you can't. In some cases, say, look, we're in a vaccine shortage situation, and we will be for a little while. People are going to be unhappy. And they'll be unhappy until it's resolved. Let's resolve it as quickly as possible rather than make people feel a sense of resolution when none exists. So in some ways, everybody, whether it's the Congress, the press, scientific experts, political opposition, they all have very valuable input in terms of what's going on. It's not always brought to you the way you want to hear it, but it is, I find it really important to try to listen and do the best job you can, and being willing to be transparent and say when we're wrong. I had a very small example of that in one of my early press conferences. I got asked a question about how we were sending out the needles for the Pfizer vaccine, and I gave an answer. I said, I think this is the answer. And I decided to go back and check, and I went back and checked, and it turned out the answer was slightly different. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm putting in my script that I said something wrong, and I'm correcting it. And it was a real interesting test for everybody, because I felt that level of reflection would be an important signal. And, you know, not to beat myself up over it, but to say, hey, you asked this, I'm accountable for giving you the truth. What I said was, there's a better way to say it, and here's what it is.
That's how you build trust. That's how you build trust. It's really important.
Yeah, that would operate.
Let's talk about life with Joe and Kamala. You've gotten a chance to know the president and the vice president. What are they like? Any stories you can share with us?
It's funny you say this. Like I was walking into the White House grounds a couple Saturdays ago for a meeting in the Roosevelt Room, and someone's walking out, and I recognize she's wearing a mask and a baseball hat. I recognize her face, but I can't quite place her for the moment. She says, "Oh, hi, Andy. You're doing great on TV. I just saw you," or something. And I said, "Oh, hi. Thank you, Madam Vice President." And because she got really close to me, touched my arm, I was like, I think I recognize, but it's very hard. You know, someone's wearing a baseball cap and casual clothes. She was going out for a walk with her husband and trying to say Mr. Second Gentleman on the spur of your tongue. That's not so such a.
That's pretty tricky, yeah.
let me start with her. She's involved in every meeting. She's very, very sharp, very inquisitive, very creative, reads everything, very tough. Biden is interesting because it's in many ways, the only other president that I've had opportunity to brief is Barack Obama. And there's a big difference. So I was sitting in my office the other day, and it's funny, my phone rang, and I was on a call with all the pharma CEOs. And I just started, I was on a Zoom call. So my phone rings and it said spam risk. Did you ever get that on your phone where it says spam risk?
Oh, sure.
So I clicked it off. And it's at spam risk, Washington, D.C. A minute later, it rings again. Spam risk, Washington, D.C. So I put my other call on hold, and it's the switchboard. And I said, "That's great. What switchboard?" I'm like, "Oh, it's the White House switchboard." I said, "Oh." And they said, "You know, the president's assistant wants to talk to you. Can you talk to her?" So I said, "Sure." So she comes on, and she says, "Can you be in the Oval for a meeting that's already started, the president wants you to be in?" So I'm like looking at these pharma CEOs, and I'm like, okay, I think I got what I need here. I got to go. So I book on over, you know, in the Oval, and the president's in the dining room that's adjacent to the Oval with Ron Klain and Jeff Zients. And, you know, the president wants to have a conversation about how to talk to the public about what's going on with the virus and with vaccines, et cetera. And what was really interesting is he doesn't want to know what will look good. He doesn't want to know how to spin things. He doesn't want any of the politics. He doesn't want to know anything fancy. He's like, "I want to give the public straight answers. I want to explain this to people in a way that, as he said, a junior in high school will understand it. So if the answer to the straightforward question of when will I get vaccinated is I don't know, I want to say I don't know and then tell people when we'll know. If the answer to the question of how many vaccines we have is, I want to give them the exact answer. I don't want to spin it." And I think the thing that is, not that you could spin Barack Obama, he's way too smart for that, but he was very analytical. President Biden wants to know how to best give the public clear information. And he wants us to work hard and solve these problems. But he doesn't want spin. He wants stuff that connects to people, that people want to hear and want to know. And he reminds us constantly that if things are challenging for people, there are some people that they're even more challenging for. Mm-hmm. And they ask a lot about health equity. It's probably the question that I've seen the two of them ask the most is, how do we help people who are in the most challenged situation and circumstances? And if you think about it, Bob, you're a boss of a lot of people. And you've had bosses in your career. The thing that you're interested in, your staff knows, right? Your staff knows Bob cares about blank. So when you're not in the room, they spend a lot of their time and energy thinking about blank because they know it's important. And it's great to have a boss who is not fixated on the politics, is fixated on solving the problem, being very clear and honest with the public and health equity issues, because you feel pretty strong sense of freedom that when you're working on this problem, to be inclined that way, and that's the culture of the administration. And that's, I think, one of the nicest things about being here is I feel like I've got the same values as the other people here. And that's a great feeling. People who've ever been in environments, whether it's with your own family or with friends, where you feel like we share the same values, everything else is easier.
Yeah. One of the things that strikes me from listening to the podcast over the past year with you is that you managed to keep it light despite the heaviness. Are there ever light moments that you've experienced with in this job? It sounds heavy and 24/7.
I like to laugh, and I probably like cut tension by allowing people to poke fun at me or poking fun at myself, like recognizing people's work and thanking them. And so, it's serious and it's intense, but there's funny moments. I mean, there are for sure funny moments, and most of them are like a stupid thing that I did or said or was about to do or almost did and caught myself and then say, oh my God, you wouldn't believe what I almost did, right? There's a lot of that stuff that just gets you through and keeps you going and keeps it good. People are very real. There's not a robotic feel to any of this. So even the hard work, even the difficult moments, it's more rewarding because you feel like you can be yourself and people are themselves and contributing and not perfect, but more dedicated. People are more dedicated to this probably than anything they've been in their entire life. So, in that sense, I'm appreciative to be part of it. It wasn't something, as it wasn't something I expected to be doing. It wasn't something I was looking to do. And it wasn't something that at first I was, in the mode of doing. I had a whole year planned out of plenty of other things. But it is a privilege. I do feel very fortunate to be part of it.
Sounds immensely gratifying.
I'm going to be walking now to our press briefing because I got a press briefing starting in 5 minutes, and it will scream like crazy if I'm not there like in a minute from now.
Maybe last question then is, this pandemic is going to end eventually. What is the future of this podcast?
Look, I think the audiences will decide that. I mean, if the audience wants to hear from somebody, whether it's you, I leave this place at the end of May, and says, whether it's in the bubble or getting outside of the bubble or sorting through the challenges that, all this has created for us or new challenges, I'm hopeful that people feel that it's a really distinct voice that they want to keep listening to. I selfishly freaking loved doing it. So I would say that, I'm not going to do it for myself, so I wouldn't be on there talking to no audience. But if there's a big audience that says, I want to hear from you and your guests, and this is what I want to hear, we'll pay attention to that. And as we could spend a lot of time talking about people at Lemonade Media, but they know how to do this stuff. I mean, they're great, great people.
They're fantastic. Absolutely terrific. All right, we should let you go. Thank you. You're the best. And this has been an amazing opportunity for me, and the team is fantastic. And thank you for everything you're doing. You are saving lives every single day, and we're really grateful.
I really want to tell the audience how much I miss them all. It's hard to believe, but I kind of feel like I know them. So I miss them all.
Yeah. Well, they miss you too. All right. Be well. Stay safe. We'll look forward to more stuff out of you and the team there. You're doing great work. Thanks so much.
All right. Bye, guys.
A profound thanks to Andy Slavitt, partly because this show wouldn't be here without him, partly because it's pretty gratifying that despite the fact that he's pretty busy, I would think, he's still taking the time to listen to us and critique us. But mostly because of the work that he is doing. And you can, I mean, those of you who know him from the show know how passionate he is about the work and getting it right, and how much he is driven by all of these deaths and tragedies, and doing everything that is humanly possible to have fewer of them as we go forward. So it was great to hear about all the things that they're doing. It's also one of the things I've always admired about Andy during the time when he ran Medicare and Medicaid, and now is, you know, he's at this point, he's a government bureaucrat, but he doesn't talk in bureaucraties. He talks truth. He's authentic. He's him. He can't help but be him. And I think that's what everybody loves about him, and why it was so nice to have him on the show. You may have heard the audio changing for the last 3 to 5 minutes. So the first 45 minutes or so was him sitting in an office, and the last 3 to 5 minutes was him running through the halls of a building that I believe was the White House, on his way to one of his 3 times a week briefings. And I think he may have almost been late because he spent a little too much time with us. But so that's our Andy. It was really terrific to have him and to hear about the things that the government is now doing to get things right. And I think that they're pretty much doing everything they can do. So it's partly why I'm much more optimistic about things than I would have been a few months ago. We have some other great shows coming up, and I think they are clear evidence of the variety we have here on In the Bubble. The next will be with Peter Hotez, one of the world experts on vaccines. You have seen him on many, many cable news shows. He's the guy with the bow tie. So we'll talk to him about the vaccines, the new vaccines coming out, whether you should skip the second dose, what happens with all of the variants, should we be worried about the UK one or the South African one? We'll get into all that. It's really it'll be a fascinating show. We'll switch gears for the next one, which will be our time with the Platt family. Actually, not all of them, but 3 members of the Platt family, Mark, Jonah, and Ben. Both Jonah and Ben had COVID. So we'll hear about their personal experience, but probably spend most of our time talking about the impact of COVID on the arts and how people have made it through this year in the arts. And many of them have struggled quite a bit, and how the arts have managed to keep producing, for example, producing movies during COVID, which is quite a story. Some of the things they've had to do to get movies out there. Then we'll shift gears again, and we'll talk about Israel. Israel has become the A-plus student when it comes to a national vaccination program. You've probably heard that, whereas in the United States, we're at about 15% of people vaccinated. Israel is about 2/3 of their population now having been vaccinated. And that's terrific for them, but it's also given us an early view of what happens when a country gets vaccinated. So lots of great stuff coming up here on In the Bubble. Look forward to having you with us. Until then, please stay safe. We're a production of Lemonada Media. Chrissy Pease and Alex McGowan produced our show. Our mix is by Ivan Kuryev. Jessica Cordova Kramer and Stephanie Whittleswax executive produced the show. Our theme was composed by Dan Molad and Oliver Hill, and additional music by Ivan Kuryev. You can find out more about our show on social media at In the Bubble Pod. Until next time, stay safe and stay sane. Thanks so much for listening.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere, and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people, and we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my 2 friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Freedom! Hi, I'm Paul F. Tompkins.
I'm Lauren Lapkus.
And I'm Scott Aukerman, and together we make up the show
Freedom!
We're comedians from Los Angeles who are also friends.
Yeah, that's weird, isn't it? And on our podcast, we just chat with each other, have fun, play games. It's just a good hang.
We just talk about everything that's happened in our lives ever before and up to now and what will happen next.
We see the future.
So the new season's out now. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts.
Wherever you get them.
Wherever.
Listen.
Wherever.
Bye.